Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 10th of July, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host this afternoon, Mike Robinson and myself, Brian Gerrish. We're delighted to be joined by Mark Anderson, Truthhound. Really hot, Mike.
It is, but possibly not as hot as in the cabinet room. But anyway, the international responses to Boris Johnson's resignation are coming in. Here's Bashar al-Assad. Who's surprised? He said, Boris said I had to go. There you go. Boris is gone. And there is a new cabinet, and here it is. And aren't they a motley looking bunch?
Doesn't that sight just fill you with confidence? There's Gove and who's behind him? Gavin Williamson there on the right.
And Liam Fox.
And Liam Fox. All the same old faces. I'm just going to say at this point, I don't think that we have a government at the moment. I think we have a cabal of people, nothing to do with a democratic system at all.
Coven maybe, but anyway, let's have a look at the reshuffle then. Jeremy Hunt has left the health department. He said, damn you, Boris, because he wanted to see through NHS privatisation, but because Theresa May needed to shore up support in the cabinet, he has been moved to become foreign secretary. Here is Dominic Raab. He has become Brexit secretary. And what did he say? He said, yes, I was a member of the British ultra-liberal youth private Facebook group. And yes, I do want the NHS to be privatised and workhouses for the poor, but I will deliver Brexit. So that's good stuff. So just to give some...
Paraphrase.
Absolutely. Just to give some idea of who it is we've got moving into these jobs. The ex-digital minister has now become an NHS AI bot, and that's Matthew Hancock. So he's now in charge of health. And he said, she gave me health. Well, I expect healthcare is much simpler when you're all made of silicon. He will continue his efforts to turn us carbon-based life forms into silicon-based life forms. And on we go. Who's next? Well, Jeremy Wright has moved into the Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport. No better place, he said, than to pursue the digitization of Britain's court system. So no doubt that will be one of his top priorities. He was Attorney General. And who's moved into that job? Well, a backbencher, Geoffrey Cox. And he said, well, yes, I know I invested in an alleged tax avoidance scheme. And yes, I know I've acted on behalf of clients in tax haven jurisdictions, but I'm honest, Gov, is what he said. Well, so he, of course, is an MP from not too far away from ourselves, Brian, North Devon, and a Silk. He's a QC and has now become Attorney General. Can't think of a better person for the job, really.
Well, he's honest, so that's the main thing. Independent. He'll be independent as well as
absolutely,
honest.
Absolutely. Independent and
so
honest.
That's all good news so far.
Absolutely. So how is the Tory party hanging together? Well, this is what Sir Alan Duncan tweeted out earlier on. Rees-Mogg's insolence in the Telegraph in lecturing and threatening the Prime Minister is just too much. Risks debasing the government, the party, the country and himself. Prime Minister must be given maximum latitude and backing. The ideological right are a minority despite their noise and should pipe down.
Mm. It's interesting that the country comes after the government and the party.
I think that is quite an accurate idea of what is in this man's mind, probably in all their minds, all 650 of them. What did Boris have to say about that? He said, it's vital that all MPs are able to air their views on Brexit. Whatever your position, I hope we can all agree that Jacob Rees-Mogg is a principled and dedicated MP who wants the best for our country. So there you go. That's what's been going on this morning. But of course, yesterday afternoon, Theresa May gave a briefing to the House of Commons on her new deal for Brexit. So I thought we would have a look at a couple of little excerpts from that and discuss those.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, on Friday at Chequers, the Cabinet agreed a comprehensive and ambitious proposal that provides a responsible and credible basis for progressing negotiations with the EU towards a new relationship after we leave on the 29th of March next year. It is a proposal that will take back control of our borders, our money and our laws. But do so in a way that protects jobs, allows us to strike new trade deals through an independent trade policy, and keeps our people safe and our union together. Before I set out the details of this proposal, I want to start by explaining why we are putting it forward. The negotiations so far have settled virtually all of the withdrawal agreement, and we've agreed an implementation period which will provide businesses and governments the time to prepare for our future relationship with the EU. The Cabinet agreed that we need to present the EU with a new model, evolving the position that I had set out in my Mansion House speech, so that we can accelerate negotiations over the summer, secure that new relationship in the autumn, pass the Withdrawal and Implementation Bill and leave the European Union on the 29th of March 2019. Mr. Speaker, the friction-free movement of goods is the only way to avoid a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland, and between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. And it is the only way to protect the uniquely integrated supply chains and just-in-time processes on which millions of jobs and livelihoods depend. So at the heart of our proposal is a UK-EU free trade area which will avoid the need for customs and regulatory checks at the border and protect those supply chains. To achieve this requires four steps. First, a commitment to maintaining a common rulebook for industrial goods and agricultural products. To deliver this, the UK would make an upfront, sovereign choice to commit to ongoing harmonisation with EU rules on goods. The regulations that are covered are relatively stable and are supported by a large share of our manufacturing businesses. And we would continue to play a strong role in shaping the European and international standards that underpin them. And there would be a parliamentary lock on all new rules and regulations. Because when we leave the EU, we will end the direct effect of EU law in the UK. All laws in the UK will be passed in Westminster, Edinburgh, Cardiff and Belfast. Our Parliament would have the sovereign ability to reject any proposals if it so chose, recognising there will be consequences, including for market access, if we chose a different approach from the EU.
Right, I'm sorry for the length of that, but there were a number of points in there that I wanted to highlight. First of all, keeping our union together. That, of course, I would argue was not talking about the United Kingdom. She was talking about the European Union. And the European Union experiencing some existential threats at the moment, and this, I think, is her top priority. But this is clearly a redefinition of the term sovereign, because, of course, what she's saying here, what was it she said? That the
sharing a common rule book.
Yeah, the common rule book is one part of
and
it. But
that was an upfront sovereign choice.
An upfront sovereign decision by the UK, but with recognising the fact that if they took a different view, that would have effect on the ability to trade and the ability to interact with the European Union. So, in other words, there is no choice. So it's a sovereign decision to be a colony, as some people are talking about.
Yes.
It's an incredible situation. Now, it didn't end there because, of course, what she was talking about there was this free trade area, which is effectively a single market, is it not? But she went on then to talk about a customs union.
Cabinet also agreed to put forward a new business-friendly customs model, a facilitated customs arrangement. This would remove the need for customs checks and controls between the UK and the EU, because we would operate as if a combined customs territory. Crucially, it would also allow the UK to pursue an independent trade policy. The UK would apply the UK's tariffs and trade policy for goods intended for the UK, and the EU's tariffs and trade policy for goods intended for the EU. 96% of businesses would be able to pay the correct tariff or no tariff at the UK border, so there would be no additional burdens for them compared to the status quo, and they would be able to benefit from the new trade deals that we will strike.
So what we're talking about here, a facilitated customs arrangement, a customs union, in other words.
Yeah.
Now, the only marginal advantage there is that Britain, she says, would be able to set its own tariffs, and therefore, we would be able to charge – companies that are only importing goods to the UK and not to the rest of the European Union a different rate to the rest of the European Union. But that, of course, is very much dependent on what the rules are with regard to trading with the European Union. And at this point, that's not decided. So it's not clear that she can actually make that claim. Here's the point. The best of both worlds. I want to highlight this once again, because this is the agreement that David Cameron, the delightful David Cameron, negotiated in the run-up to the referendum itself. This is a white paper, which was actually a legally binding agreement. And I just want to highlight a few quotes out of this, because this is what he said. We've secured a new settlement to give the United Kingdom special status in the European Union. As this white paper sets out, we will be permanently out of ever closer union, ensuring that we can never be part of a European superstate. There will be tough new restrictions on access to our welfare system for EU migrants, so that people who come to our country can no longer take out before putting something in. And we have also secured vital protections for our economy with a full say over the rules of free trade single market while remaining outside the Eurozone. He went on to say, our special status gives us the best of both worlds. We will be in the parts of Europe that work for us, influencing the decisions that affect us, in the driving seat of the world's biggest market, and with the ability to take action to keep our people safe. But we will be out of the parts of Europe that do not work for us. So as well as being out of ever closer union, we will never join the euro and never be part of Eurozone bailouts or the passport-free no borders area. And he said, the reforms we secured in this negotiation have been agreed by all 28 EU leaders. They are legally binding and cannot be unpicked without our agreement and that of every other EU country. All 28 member states were also clear that the treaties would have to be changed to incorporate the protections for the UK as an economy outside the Eurozone and our permanent exclusion from ever closer unions. So that is what David Cameron said in 2015. As I've said several times before, I'm not quite certain what the difference is between that document and what Theresa May has been proposing in her Mansion House speech, what she proposed yesterday. And in fact, this was recognised on BBC News just before the Friday Chequers meeting, because what this article here says, Brexit customs plan will offer best of both worlds. A new plan for post-Brexit customs arrangements will be a significant step forward, a Downing Street source has promised. The proposal to be presented to ministers on Friday will offer the best of both worlds, an independent trade policy and friction-free trade, the source added, but no details have yet been revealed about how it will work. Well, the details have now been revealed. And if you actually read the Best of Both Worlds white paper, it's pretty difficult to see the difference. But anyway, we move on because, of course, she was talking yesterday about free trade as well. So let's just listen to this short clip.
Some have suggested that under this arrangement, the UK would not be able to do trade deals. They are wrong. When we have left the EU, the UK will have our own independent trade policy with our own seat at the World Trade Organization and the ability to set tariffs for our trade with the rest of the world. We will be able to pursue trade agreements with key partners, and on Friday, the Cabinet agreed that we would consider seeking accession to the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership.
So this is a spectacular position, Brian, because the best of both worlds had trade at the centre of that. Britain is putting trade at the centre of its hashtag Global Britain policy. And now Theresa May is announcing, without so much as a by your leave in Parliament, that as part of Brexit, under the veneer of Brexit, Britain is going to attempt to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is spectacular. Now, the best of both worlds document said the EU will pursue with renewed commitment, free trade agreements with the world's most dynamic economies, so that the tariff and regulatory barriers faced by UK companies in large and growing non-EU markets are reduced or eliminated. Now, the fact is that the EU is diverted somewhat with EU military unification, with banking union, with setting up an EU treasury, and they don't have the resource and the time to put into building EU trade agreements. And what my assessment of this, Brian, is, and other people will disagree, but my assessment has always been that Britain has positioned itself at the centre of a network of trade agreements. They are taking on the role that Cameron had originally envisaged that the EU would take on to build these external non-EU market trading agreements with Britain at the hub. But Britain will still have this relationship with the EU of greater and broader, greater depth and of greater significance than we've ever had before. And the EU will then get access to these other trade agreements through the UK rather than the other way around. It's quite an interesting approach, but I don't believe, with TTIP failing and so on, and with the other issues that the EU faces at the moment, I don't believe that Britain is prepared to throw away the effort that it has made to build these multinational trading agreements like TTIP and TPP. And with Trump having withdrawn from TPP, Britain sees a need to have what they see as a significant partner involved in that trading agreement. So what's the Irish government's approach to Theresa's proposals? Well, they have welcomed the proposals from the British government, which can input into talks into the future relationship with the EU. And Leo Varadkar here saying that he awaits details in the white paper. Well, that white paper is going to be published on Thursday now, so we will look forward to seeing that. What are your thoughts?
Well, I was going to pass it to Mark, actually, and see what an independent viewer has to say. Massive movements in British politics here.
The thing that strikes me the most, guys, is that it looks like David Cameron's best of both worlds was the pre-written, preemptive way of having the fix in. In other words, the fix was in through the best of both worlds. In other words, what the British government is doing since the best of both worlds white paper was written is just implementing the best of both worlds. So it could even have possibly come from Bilderberg or some other inside private government groups, private governance groups that help put the best of both worlds together to preempt whatever the British government would do and put the fix in long before even Brexit happened, before the vote even happened.
Well, that's an interesting observation, Mark, because actually in the Best of Both Worlds document, David Cameron makes the observation that it doesn't really matter what the outcome of the referendum is, that he has got a plan for that. And I believe that's exactly what we've seen.
Exactly. This is how private government works with the networking of these think tanks and these institutes that we keep an eye on. They basically have the burgers already cooked before the food stand even opens. And so it's very deceptive, and that's how they work.
Absolutely. Well, good news, Brian, good news, because apparently if the great Brexit betrayal isn't reversed, says Nigel Farage writing in the Telegraph today, he will have no choice but to return as UKIP leader. And he's saying that in July 2017, that he had written in the Telegraph that the great Brexit betrayal had begun. I would argue somewhat different. I think the great Brexit betrayal had begun on the day of the referendum vote. And in fact, possibly once again on the day that Nigel Farage resigned as leader of UKIP in the first place.
Well, you know my views on Nigel Farage. He abandoned the party at the critical moment when he could have been mustering the full force of those 17.4 million people who voted for Brexit. He could have made UKIP at that stage a fully electable party, but he didn't. He said he had to leave politics because he'd been threatened, but he then appeared in public, of course, with Mr. Trump. He then sits in the background and does nothing. And now, after we've been betrayed, he says, oh, well, perhaps I'll step forward again. He's either not very bright or he's complicit in the whole deceit on the nation. I can't work out which it is, but it's one of the two.
Well, we mentioned yesterday that it was happening. It has now happened. The joint declaration on EU-NATO cooperation has been signed. Well, here's the key clause here. We welcome EU efforts to bolster European security and defence, to better protect the Union and its citizens, and to contribute to peace and stability in the neighbourhood and beyond. The Permanent Structured Cooperation and the European Defence Fund contribute to these objectives. So anybody, for example, Nigel Farage, is suggesting that the EU and NATO are not bound together on this issue of defence that EU military unification is in any way undermining NATO is totally incorrect. And of course, this declaration signed by Donald Tusk there on the left, Jens Stoltenberg in the middle, and Jean-Claude Juncker on the right. Donald Tusk, after he signed that document, had this to say about Donald Trump: appreciate your allies, you don't have many. And what's he talking about? Well, of course, he's talking about the issue of funding for NATO and defence funding in the European Union, because Donald Trump at the moment threatening to withdraw US troops and material from Europe unless the EU decides to pay up. And his issue is, as he highlighted at the NATO summit last year, his issue is that EU countries not paying their requisite 2% of GDP. The NATO summit starts tomorrow, and Jens Stoltenberg giving his sort of prequel to that today, this morning. And he's pretty positive about how things are moving on. He said, 2 years ago in Warsaw, we came together to strengthen EU-NATO cooperation, aiming to promote peace and stability in the Euro-Atlantic area. Our respective efforts are mutually reinforcing, have improved the security of our citizens and strengthened our transatlantic bond. Our long-standing cooperation has developed substantially and is now unprecedented in its quality, scope and rigour. But nonetheless, he was a little concerned about Donald Trump's determination that, last year when we were talking about this, we said that Trump was almost like a mafia don, putting the protection racket, the protection demands on the rest of the EU. So Stoltenberg, his message really is, look, Donald, we hate that you're visiting Putin. We hate that you're bullying us. So we're going to fudge the figures to make you look like an idiot. And so what figures are we talking about here? Well, this is the funding for defence in the EU figures, because Stoltenberg has said that it's all very encouraging, because in 2014, only three members of NATO were spending 2% or more on GDP. And this year, it's now eight. And so he had an article in the Washington Post where he said that, this year we're expecting the number to rise to eight, which is adding Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland and Romania. Well, is that really pretty exciting in terms of overall NATO budget there, Brian? Because I don't imagine that the GDPs of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland and Romania really come up to scratch compared to, say, France and Germany, for example, who just simply aren't putting 2% into defence. He said that the combined budget rise was 5.2%, the biggest increase in real terms in a quarter of a century. And now 2018 will be the fourth consecutive year of rising spending. But they're all really upset about Donald heading over to meet Putin. And they're using this as kind of a battering ram, it seems, to try to just...
Yeah, they're panicking. Because there is no NATO without America. And it isn't simply down to budget. Part of it is that the American armed forces are American armed forces. They know how to operate together. Of course, they're Americans. They can operate together effectively. They're using American equipment. And so their overall efficiency is very high. The moment you come into Europe, whatever they say about interoperability, it doesn't really happen between European nations. It's better with some than others. But you've got a chaotic system with language problems, with military slang, with different equipment. Europe is I'm going to use the expression, a dog's breakfast when it comes to this so-called unified defence system. America pulls out. The reality of that is highlighted.
Mark, is any of this getting coverage in the United States? Is there any awareness in the US that Trump is making such waves in Europe?
Not a great deal, because there's so much focus right now that he picked Brett Kavanaugh to be the next Supreme Court nominee, and that's really eaten up the news for the last 12 to 24 hours. It's really just a side story right now for the most part.
You have wanted to highlight this article in The Economist, which is really talking about what we've mentioned. The Western Alliance is in trouble. The Economist, of course, many would argue is a mouthpiece for City of London interests. Is this really their observation?
It seems to be a house editorial. There's no byline on here. Of course, the House editorial can mean it's basically what it is, and that's the City of London / Bilderberg mouthpiece. And we have to take it for what it is. Zanny Minton-Beddoes, of course, the Economist editor, attends Bilderberg pretty much every year. And this article seems to be right on time. It came out about July 6th, and they're saying things like, today, however, America and Europe are separated by a growing rift. The mood before the NATO summit in Brussels on July 11 and 12 is poisonous, they claim, which is really an exaggerated concept. It's not poisonous. Donald Trump is simply demanding that countries that are running huge trade surpluses with the U.S. are getting even more money through the trade brokering and should be able to easily meet their 2% GDP requisite amount that you spoke of a few minutes ago. And so Trump is really just looking for equity mostly and fairness if the U.S. is going to continue to be this ever-present guardian of the Western alliance. But they go on to say, though, and that's what this article is about, that the Western alliance, quote, is in trouble, and this should worry Europe, America, and the world. And that, of course, echoes some other research I've been looking into by the German Marshall Fund and whatnot. There seems to be a growing chorus, even stronger than it was a month ago, right after Bilderberg in Italy. There's this growing chorus that the U.S. is not just putting TTIP aside or putting the Paris Agreement aside and elements of the liberal world order. But now, a month later, there's this chorus, and The Economist is part of it. They're saying that the U.S. under Donald Trump is kicking the entire liberal world order to the curb, not just components of it. So the NATO summit is just another stop along the way, and they're using that as an example to say that they're worried that Trump is going to jettison the entire global world order, the post-World War II system put in at Bretton Woods, nurtured at Bilderberg, and the whole nine yards. So it's all very interesting. And I see you're showing the German Marshall Fund piece. That came out a little longer ago in 2017, to be clear. Some of this I discovered retroactively, but in the German Marshall Fund piece, which was written by 12 scholars, including from the German Council on Foreign Relations, two from the Aspen Institute, they say, quote, the liberal world order, with its foundation in multilateralism, its global norms and values, its open societies and markets, is in danger. And it is exactly this order on which Germany's freedom and prosperity depends. Well, when they say Germany's freedom and prosperity, they really mean the political parties, the elite, the investment class, the bankers, and the power brokers. Germany's prosperity is not necessarily found in the global world order. In fact, Germany is under great stress from the heavy movement of migrants brought on by Western wars in other countries and all the different things that the Western alliance is doing, acting like gangsters, driving people from one country to another, creating poverty, creating upheaval. The German people arguably would be a lot better off without many elements of the modern Western alliance. Mm-hmm. So between the German Marshall Fund report and the Economist article, and there are others, probably a little too lengthy to mention here for just today, they're really concerned that Donald Trump is taking the entire liberal world order to task. How accurate that is, we can't say with certainty. Is Donald Trump just getting into a little bit of anti-globalist theater here? It remains to be seen, but it's very interesting how much he is shaking up the think tanks and the Bilderberg people and the whole internationalist establishment. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens in just the next few days, going to London, going to the NATO summit, and going to meet Putin in Helsinki.
Well, I suppose the big question is, he is coming to London on Friday. Will he leave again in one piece?
Remains to be seen. Mark, I think we're going to shock you a little bit here. This is a report that was highlighted to me a few days ago. It's come from the BBC's business section. And here's the headline, The Tarot Revival Thanks to Brexit, Trump and Dior. We'll put in a bit of text here. Our societies are going through an extreme sense of alienation, said a Miss Vogel. I think that's a lady that's produced some of these cards, mentioning Donald Trump's presidential victory in the US, as well as the rise of far-right groups, violence and misogyny, people are lonely and angry. Tarot helps them to cope with insecurity in these difficult times. So there you have the start of it, Mark, that the BBC is using a particular lady journalist in its business section to actually promote the use of tarot cards against Donald Trump. This is really quite an extraordinary piece of work by the BBC. Here's a little bit more of it. One example of this is the hashtag Magic Resistance Movement. Every month, self-identifying witches gather to cast mass spells on Donald Trump and use tarot to assist them in the task. So I'll let you come in just very briefly because I've got a bit more of the analysis on this one to do. But here is the British broadcasting company, £3.74 billion, apparently independent, truthful reporting, telling us truthfully that tarot cards and casting of witches' spells are the way to get rid of your president.
That's truly shocking. And from what I gather, they're actually serious. I don't detect any tongue-in-cheek. I don't detect any parody or satire there. Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct. And if we just follow on through, I think possibly your jaw will be on the floor. Here's a bit more. It says the tower card, commonly used in Trump spells, depicts a solid tower being struck by lightning and flames emerging from small windows at the top. Tina Gong, a New York-based designer and witch, says the rise of tarot has everything to do with our current political and socio and economic environment. Ms. Gong combined her love of witchcraft and her coding skills to create tarot apps, as well as an online tarot school. She describes the majority of her users as young females. And the witch symbolizes everyone that has been an other and that has no place or control in the world, such as women, people of color, LGBTQ community. So there we are. The BBC really getting the detail in about who's into the witchcraft and the tarot cards and encouraging people to get involved. But it gets better because they also quote this gentleman, Mike Sosterick. And what does he say? Let's bring him on the screen for me to be able to read. During the transformation from feudalism to capitalism, the ruling classes used tarot to gamify the civilization building process. The cards guided people about the new roles in the society. They helped the ruling classes to mobilize and manage the masses. So I think there's a bit of a deeper meaning, Mark, to this whole article, because this astute sociologist is telling us that these tarot cards are important to the people making the political decisions. Hillary Clinton's team, maybe?
It could very well be. It gives a little bit more credence to bloggers like Henry Macko in Canada that are often saying that there's a satanic and occultic element to the transnational leadership, the ruling class. And I've always kept that kind of as an agnostic from my standpoint. In other words, I don't try to go both feet into that theory that everybody's a Satanist. But this gives a little more credence to the possibility and probability to the occultic undercurrent of all that's going on. The fact that they're actually serious about this, I guess the upside is that it discredits the mainstream media even more, as alternative media like ours makes tremendous strides. And I'll talk about something like that in a second. And it just shows how ridiculous, in particular, not just the mainstream media is in general, but how completely illegitimate the BBC should be seen as, for all the money that the Brits pay for TV taxes and whatnot, as if you need more proof that the BBC is completely out to lunch and subversive. This just puts the capstone on the pyramid. And so really, they're their own worst enemy. It's just the fact that they take it seriously. It shows their mentality. I mean, this is almost up there with spirit cooking allegations. It's really disturbing.
It's sorry to cut across you there, Mark. Let me just bring in a little bit more on this gentleman, Mike Sosterick. This is from his Sojourn website. He says, as noted in 2003, a series of powerful mystical experiences rocked my emotional, psychological, and conceptual world. The first experience occurred while I was watching the movie The Abyss. In that experience, which was fueled by a small dose of cannabis, I had a horrifying conversation with God where I rehearsed in terrifying detail all the Catholic ideas about judgment and damnation that I'd been indoctrinated with as a child. So he's temporarily high on drugs and he thinks he's having a conversation with God. This is the man chosen by the BBC to advise people in UK. But this man went on to say this, which I found pretty astonishing. As noted in the sidebar, I had a similar paranoid experience in the past. However, the past, I always succumbed to the fear. I always quit pot smoking and pretended the experiences didn't happen. I never talked openly about them until now, primarily because I was afraid people would think I was a crazy schizophrenic or something like that. Even now, as I write these words, I know some readers will be thinking just that. It was different this time, though. This time I didn't give in to the fear. This time I stood up and I told God to F off. So this is the quality of the man that the BBC is using to reinforce their story that witches can use tarot cards to help undermine the president of the United States. I don't think it could get more base than that, Mark, and I don't think this is an accident by the BBC. I think there's a very big message here.
Well, yeah, just as I spoke a couple minutes ago of the transnational establishment being worried that Trump is taking apart the whole kit and caboodle and not just elements of it, this sort of goes off from the geopolitical off into the more esoteric realms, but there seems to be a continuity between the two. They are so scared that they're resorting to something as puerile and nasty and ridiculous as this. It just shows the length and breadth of their desperation. And again, that's the upside of it. It shows just how desperate they are. You know, the guy talks about religious indoctrination. The secular humanism and the occultism that he's drunk with, that's the indoctrination, not Christianity, not the basic tenets of Christianity. He's been indoctrinated away from Christian precepts and into the occult. He doesn't even know what he's been indoctrinated with. And yet he's trying to indoctrinate the rest of British society through his position.
Well, and the BBC has sought him out, of course, to comment in this article. Let me just go through another step, Rick, because we'll end by having a look at who wrote this article. Well, here's the article again. And this is the lady concerned, Didim Tali. Well, who is she? Well, she's a freelance journalist. This is obviously her Twitter page where she's boasting about the very article itself. What business experience does she really have? Well, I couldn't really find any. She's gone around the world doing journalism on some very interesting stuff. In some cases, she's been into the Amazon looking at tree felling and how that's destroying communities. She's very into women's rights. But who is this woman, really? You don't know. She's just a freelancer that the BBC's brought in. I just find this one of the most incredible BBC articles because it's in the business section. If this was in social entertainment media cartoon fun, I could perhaps think, yeah, but it's not. It's in the business section. Okay, well, let's move to reality. And the reality is that there was a court hearing today for Melanie Shaw, Leeds Crown Court. Melanie has been charged with 3 arson and 1 sexual assault offences. And we believe what took place today was a brief mentions hearing. And in the hearing, they're calling now for psychiatric reports on Melanie Shaw. And basically, they're looking to have a new trial on the 7th of August 2018. That's what we think. And thank you very much to Linda for reporting this in. So this is the reality of Britain. We've got a child abuse survivor and whistleblower that is put into solitary confinement for a little bit over 18 months in order to silence her and, of course, avoid damaging the British government. And the danger is that Melanie was due for release at the beginning of this month. So that was in time for...
Actually, the beginning of last month.
You're right, Mike, yeah. The beginning of June, which would have brought her onto the streets, as it were, to speak to the so-called independent child abuse inquiry. So what happens is the charges that were actually raised against Melanie back in February 2017 are now suddenly brought to the fore. She's put on remand, she's held in prison, and now we've got a whole new trial going through in order to silence her. Why is the British state so scared of this lady? Well, Melanie has a truly phenomenal memory of not only her own abuse in Beechwood Children's Home, Nottingham, but also the connections through to politicians in Westminster, that the British state needs her silenced. And what better way than to get her into the psychiatric gulag, where presumably she can disappear. So we'd just say, if you'd like to help, one of the best things you could do is write to Melanie and give your support, and of course tell her how concerned you are. And a large volume of letters will make a big difference, not only to Melanie, but of course to the prison authorities. So her address is Melanie Shaw. Her prisoner number is A4126DE. And the address is HMP Style, that's STYAL, Wilmslow, Cheshire, SK94HR. Now, some people have said, has Melanie been able to get proper representation? And I have to say to you that at the moment, Melanie is being represented by a law firm that she has chosen. That was her decision, rightly or wrongly. And at the moment, we have to go with that decision, even though it means that people who've been able to get information a little bit closer to the case are being excluded at the moment. It's a very difficult call, but if Melanie has decided this, that has to be respected, and therefore we have to wait and see how this pans out. I'll just add that the Express was carrying this article yesterday, outrageous, Justice Secretary to spend millions on giving prisoners phones in their cells. The logic for this is that in trial prisons where prisoners have been able to call out, call family in particular from their prison cells, there's been a dramatic drop in violence, which I think is an interesting thing. David Gawke here says that once in prison, offenders deserve to live in a decent, safe and secure environment, and we want them to maintain family relationships. Of course, the exception is Melanie Shaw, and the government's got other plans for her because she's a child abuse whistleblower and very dangerous for our government. So what can you do? Well, you can consider getting some of the UK column postcards, Treason Maze Britain 2018, Melanie Shaw Prisoner Why? And maybe one of the places to send the card is to Mr. Gawke himself, the Right Honourable, of course, House of Commons, London, and the address there is on screen. Those cards are capable of making quite a difference if sent in sufficient numbers. And of course, what a boost for Melanie herself to know that people are taking action on her behalf. Mm. Mark, I've got to say, when I report on Melanie Shaw, I know there are many other people in Britain being abused in this way within the system. But it just appalls me to see Theresa May standing with her fine pearls and smart jackets and shoes, lecturing other countries on human rights and democracy. The hypocrisy is truly unpleasant.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Melanie Shaw is a very brave person. She's kind of a pivotal point. The question is, of course, becomes just how long can they keep her put away? Just how long can they avoid the truth? Because it appears, and it's a growing body of evidence, as you guys and me, as all of us know, that the child abuse racket and the child trafficking racket, which goes way back to the Nebraska affair in the U.S. and goes really around the world, and it's involved in the Central American human trafficking coming up to the Texas border and that whole border issue. That whole thing is loaded with allegations against various power brokers and politicians who've been caught in the web of sexual abuse and child abuse. And it's the way they keep people in line. It's the way they keep politicians in line, is to get them involved in these kind of things, and then they've got dirt on them, and then no one wants to speak out. Nobody wants to speak up. Excuse me. Nobody wants to step out of formation because these child abuse and child sexual abuse allegations can be smeared against anyone. Anybody can be smeared by this stuff. So it's this huge system of control that they've got put together. And Melanie Shaw is really the key that unlocks the whole thing. And so how long they're going to keep her put away, is the question, because she can open up the door to this whole Pandora's box.
Okay, well, the minimum we can say is that we won't be forgetting her, and we're making every attempt we can at the moment to make sure other people are aware of this lady and what she represents. How long do they want to keep her banged up for? Until she dies, I think, is a reasonable starting point. But if you want a shorter bracket, it's they want her out of the way until the so-called independent child abuse inquiry is over. I'll just end on this with an eye on the time. This is another article which caught my eye because I've commented before on the attention being given to hijabs in Iran. So the male here with Iranian woman is given a 20-year jail term for removing her headscarf. And this is a lady called Shapak Shazir Daya, I think. It's a tricky one, so I'm going to say Shapak, which is a first name. Here it is, an Iranian woman who protested the obligatory Islamic headscarf by removing it in public says she has been sentenced to 20 years in prison. Now, I'm fascinated because this... She was arrested in February, and if you look at the end of that little section inset, it says this week she posted on her personal website that she'd been jailed for opposing the compulsory. How was she actually posting while she was in prison, Mike?
Don't know.
No, I don't know. Well, this was one of the reports that we mentioned a while back. This was the BBC Trending, April 2016. And basically, the BBC was encouraging Iranian women to break the law over the hijab. And of course, if they were to break the law, they faced quite draconian punishment and prison sentences. But here was the BBC helping spin unrest with a sideways dig at the Russians, because it was a young Russian chap that said, of course, if you can see people's faces, they can be located very quickly. So on one hand, the BBC encourages the women to show their faces clearly. And on the other hand, they're smirking because a young Russian has said, well, if you show your face, I can find you. Now, this links through to my stealthy freedom. Excuse me. And I was intrigued with that because it's this website, the right for individual Iranian women to choose whether they want hijab. Who are the people they're working with? Well, the great and the good right the way across. So we've got the Huffington Post, Bloomberg, The Economist, The Guardian, The Washington Post. All the big boys are there, Time. And if we have a look at this bit, this is supposedly a campaign started by one woman, Masi Alinejad. But she just happens to be a journalist now for Voice of America and lives in the USA. So I'm unclear as to whether this is something she's doing personally or she's doing it with a lot of help from Voice of America. And what do they boast about? Well, they boast of this. Voice of America exports America's most powerful product. What is that product? Well, if you didn't know, it's freedom of speech, apparently.
Right. So basically what's going on is... an attempt to undermine the Iranian government from Western media, running campaigns, but possibly also training Iranian journalists, of course.
This, to me, is a mirror of BBC media action and the more devious parts of the BBC. Of course, Voice of America has its own Persian News Network section, and that's what I think this young lady is involved with. So I think this is American political policy. I'll just give you 30 seconds to end, Mark, since I've mentioned the US of A.
Well, yeah, Voice of America is really known to be an intelligence outlet, and it's always had some element of that. This is British and American intelligence operating through journalistic entities to make it look less like intelligence. I mean, that's what it really is. If you're undermining the cultures of countries and you're not just reporting the news, you are engaging in a type of cultural warfare. That is what intelligence agencies do. It's rarely the shooting kind of warfare. And if Iran really does have 20-year sentences for not wearing certain attire, that is draconian. But we have to find out, was that woman really sentenced to 20 years or any jail time? It would be draconian if it is, and that doesn't make Iran right. But we have to see this for what it is, and that's an intel operation, either directly or indirectly.
Mark, thank you for that excellent summing up. We'll leave it there. Thank you to everybody for joining us today. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.